Good morning. Finally starting, calling to order this meeting of the House Committee on Children, Families, Finance, and Policy. We will start, we have a few folks still running late, but you know what? We'll have the clerk take the roll as usual if we can. Ms. Khan.
Chair Pinto.
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler.
Present.
Lee Daniels.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Coulter.
Present.
Representative Davis.
Present.
Representative Hansen. Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Present.
Representative Hicks.
Present.
Representative Hudson.
Present.
Representative Katisa Watoon.
Present.
Representative Lee. Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Pettis Vega. Representative Zelaznikar.
Present.
We have a quorum.
We do have a quorum, and as I said, I know a couple folks are running a little bit late. And so if I can ask Vice Chair Keeler if you're willing to move approval of the minutes from our March meeting of March 21.
So moved.
Thank you. Any discussion members to the minutes or questions? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of March 21 minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? So the motion passes and the minutes are approved. So members, a few bills today. Sorry to be starting a little bit late. But before we get to the bills, we are going to have a presentation, just a brief one, on one addition to the governor's budget recommendations that's come through the supplemental budget. So I'm going to ask Jennifer Sommerfeld and Kiki Brown to make your way to the front if you can. The members in our packets, I believe anyway, is a budget change item describing this change. It says change item title MFIP sanction reform on housing assistance. And so Assistant Commissioner Brown, welcome back to the committee. If you can identify yourself and then proceed in describing this.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Tiki Brown and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to provide a brief update on last week's presentation of two recommendations recently released by the governor's revised budget that fall within this committee's jurisdiction. The governor's revised budget includes two new recommendations related to the Minnesota Family Investment Program, otherwise known as MFIB. These recommendations can be found on page 564 of the revised budget book for human services. The first new recommendation would apply a cost of living adjustment each year to the MFIB housing assistance grant beginning October 1st, 2024. The adjustment would be based on the consumer price index for the prior calendar year. Currently, the MFIB housing grant is $110 per month and is used to supplement the cash and food assistance families receive from this program. The amount of $110 of housing assistance has not changed since it was implemented in 2015. For context, fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment in the Twin Cities is currently $1,410 per month and has increased 42% since 2015. In Greater Minnesota, the average fair market for a two-bedroom apartment is currently $988 per month and has increased 32% since 2015. Under this proposal, the housing assistance grant would increase an estimated $115 per month in the first year of implementation, which would be 2024. By 2027, it is estimated to be a total of $123 per month. A cost of living adjustment will allow the MFIB housing grant to increase incrementally over time, helping families with children, help keep families with children keep up with the cost of housing.
Then please, yeah, continue.
Thank you. The second proposal is the MFIB sanctions reform. While new to the governor's revised budget, this recommendation has already been heard in this committee on February 21st as part of Representative Knorr's House File 466. As Representative Knorr explained in his presentation, the MFIB sanction policy is extremely complicated. Parents receiving assistance from MFIB can lose some or all of their family's assistance if they are not complying with the complex program rules. The current sanction process also involves extensive frontline worker time and resources. The proposal reforms MFIB sanction policies by balancing participant accountability, program predictability, and administrative ease for frontline workers. The sanction reform proposal eliminates distinct sanction policies based on how long someone has been receiving MFIB, increases the incentive to cooperate more promptly by restoring full benefits when participants return to compliance, and eliminates the need to keep counts of sanction occurrences dating back to 2003. Under this proposal, a sanction would result in a 5% reduction of the cash portion received by the family, rather than the current framework of having different percentages of 10% or 30% of the full grant amount. This change reduces complexity for frontline workers and ends the overly harsh treatment of families living in deep poverty who turn to the program for help. This program also simplifies how cases are closed for noncompliance with program rules. Currently, caseworkers need to keep track of sanctions on a running total over the lifetime of a case, whether that occurred a month ago or even a decade ago. Under this proposal, a family's case will be closed due to 7 consecutive sanction occurrences. Once a parent is in compliance, the sanction count would start back to 0. And finally, this proposal expedites the process of restoring benefits. If a parent comes back into compliance by the 15th of a month in which a sanction is being imposed, the sanction amount will be restored that month. Right now, benefits cannot be restored until the following month. While this proposal reforms sanction policies, it's important to point out that only 2% of MFIP cases, or about 500, have a sanction in any given month. Research findings suggest that many sanctioned recipients fail to comply with program requirements not because they are resistant, but because they face barriers that make it difficult for them to meet such requirements. Families with children turn to MFIP due to a job loss, health crisis, homelessness, or other events that leave them deep in poverty. Reforming sanctioned policies will positively impact these families so they don't lose most or all of their benefits when they are sanctioned. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Brown. Thanks for your work. Some members, so these are just to sort of set, make sure we're all clear on this. These are proposals that may be included in our budget bill next week. They've come out pretty recently, so that's why we're sort of receiving it just as a presentation. Assuming that they do move forward, then of course the language will be in front of us as part of that. So we'll see though if members have any questions for the commissioner about the proposals thus far. And so seeing none, thank you so much, Commissioner Brown. I'll note also in context of the supplemental budget that there is, I'm aware of an increase, just in our jurisdiction, an increase in the a budget request relating to the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and I believe also an expansion in the number of students that be served in the pre-K program that relates to changes in the formula. And those are, I think, the sum total of supplemental budget items. I'll maybe turn to our jurisdiction, see if I'm missing anything from House Research or Crystal. And I seeing head shaking, so there we go. Mr. Brown, thank you so much. And
thank
so all done. I didn't see any questions from anybody, so we'll go with our first bill then. And Representative Greenman, make your way on up, and I'll ask Vice Chair Keeler if she's willing to move to bring House Bill 2753 before us.
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Greenman, so glad to have you with us. Don't think you have any amendments, so please proceed presenting your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and it's nice to be here. This is my first time in this committee.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for the work you do. And I'm also grateful to present House Bill 2753 to support the Family Enhancement Center with an appropriation of $360,000 in 2024 and $360,000 in 2025 to support their important work. The Family Enhancement Center has a 30-year track record of serving kids and families who've experienced trauma and child abuse. They create lasting solutions to prevent and heal the abuse and provide full counseling services, in-home parent education, group therapy, parent assessments, and parent development services. In 2019, the Family Enhancement Center received a community-based coordination grant from the legislature to increase staffing and decrease mental health and decrease the mental health service waiting list. With the grant, FEC trained their staff in evidence-based trauma-informed therapy techniques and onboarded 5 new therapists, of which 3 were therapists of color. As a result, FEC has been able to decrease their waiting list and increase the diversity of the youth services provided. This important work is helping the front lines of vulnerable kids and families, and has only grown more important and urgent with the COVID pandemic. Trauma isolates families and disrupts ties to community and social support, and the COVID-19 crisis has only worsened that for everyone, but especially folks in trauma. The isolation leaves people vulnerable to mental health conditions and relapses of unsafe family patterns. The mental health treatment is critical, but so is social and community engagement, which is a key component of long-term success and healing. This important work is what FEC is seeking funding for. The grant would support their work to reconnect isolated families to their communities, programs that engage youth and families in circles of mutual aid and support that will sustain recovery and prevent relapse. Specifically, FEC has piloted 3 community-based programs that engage youth and their families in circles of mutual aid and support. The NEST program, a family mentoring program, a parent mentoring program, Fall Call to Movement, a community-based initiative to increase healthy activities and support recovery with mental health conditions, and Cook to Connect, a parent and child cooking activity that encourages attachment and community connection. These pilot programs work directly to engage vulnerable youth and their families in activities that create social ties in their community and support healthy lifestyle choices. With that, the Family Enhancement Center has a whole set of folks here, but I think we have a few testifiers to talk about the great work they do to keep kids safe and families intact.
Thank you so much, Reverend Greenman. So I think we've got Libby Bergman up next. Just a reminder, folks, to all the testifiers today, we're pretty tight on time, so we're asking folks. I think we've given a total time for each presentation and keep things tight. Ms. Bergman, welcome, and please identify yourself and proceed.
I'm Libby Bergman, and I want to thank Chair Pinto and this committee for hearing our testimony today. As you probably know, I'm the director of the Family Enhancement Center, and we've been here for 30 years working with youth and families that have been impacted by trauma. And as Representative Greenman mentioned, when trauma happens to a family, they often lose all their trust, they disconnect from the community, and they become so vulnerable to many problems. They lose their ties and their ability to seek help sometimes. And can fall into unsafe patterns, as well as have mental health conditions and substance abuse conditions can result. We all know isolation is not good for humans. We're meant to connect with each other, and so we're asking for this funding so that we can help these vulnerable children and families reconnect to their communities so that they can remain successful and safe and become healthy contributing members to society. I wanted to share a story. One of our participants that had been in one of our community connection programs 10 years ago, she is now on our board of directors. And I was chatting with her the other day, and she shared with me that she maintained a connection with one of the women she had met in the group. And I said, wow, I was surprised. 10 years you've stayed connected? And she said, yes. She said, Libby, when we went through that crisis together, we made each other strong, and we're still making each other strong today. And I just, that hit my heart, and I thought, wow, that is such an impact to be going 10 years after, the participation in our programs. So I wanted to share that, and then I'd like to have Carolyn Washington come up. She's going to share about, she's the program manager of the NEST program, and we do have, just so you know, we have a group of people here. We have a participant in the NEST program and a mentor in the NEST program. So I just wanted to
Thanks. Yeah, please. Once you get settled in, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Hi. I, mirror what Libby said. I appreciate you guys. My name is Carolyn Washington. I'm the program manager of the NEST program at Family Enhancement Center. Just want to appreciate you guys for having us here and hearing our bill today. I want to talk a little bit about the NEST program. It's a family mentoring program. At Family Enhancement Center, we help strengthen families by providing support and access to resources to keep kids safe. And I have a short testimony from one of our families that we serve. And I will read it now. My name is Julie. I'm a 60-year-old grandmother of a 7-year-old grandson. He's been with me going on 2 years. There have been multiple behavior issues. Being able to have some time apart has been critical. We was introduced to Peggy in May of 2022. Peggy has been a perfect match and an extraordinary support to me and my grandson. She have taken him out to summer activities, indoors, outdoors, some of which I would never have been able to do because of my health issues. I have been made to feel like I have a lifelong friend and a family member. Words from one of our volunteers. I believe in families and reaching back and helping families have been well rewarded. I've been given a great opportunity to give back to others by mentoring through encouragement, friendship, and sharing of resources made available at the Nest. Each member can find their place in a functioning society. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I would like to introduce Holly Clark.
Yeah, come on up, yeah. I should say we're over the allocated time for the bill. Come on up, yeah, no problem. But I'm just going to ask you if you can to just to keep it pretty brief, but definitely do want to hear from you. And so once you get settled in, identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, I'm Holly Clark. I'm a therapist at Family Enhancement Center, and I can make it quick.
No problem.
So I wanted to share a story about a community engagement event that we had and how that directly impacted some of our families. So this past summer, kind of early into the fall, we started a back-to-school event that we hosted at a local park, and we had contacted with another local nonprofit, and they were able to donate backpacks. And so we had this as an opportunity to come together and also get support or services that they may need. Staff provided a kind of a potluck type style meal for the families, and we had a good chunk of families come out and really just be together and connect. And as this has already been spoken to, we know that abuse and trauma can cause isolation, so that connectedness and sense of belonging was really important, and I know really dear to a lot of our hearts to see our families connect with one another and just really enjoy each other and be present in the moment. Trauma can often keep us in the past or have us anxious about the future, and these families were able to just be together in the present moment. I had a teenage client who had recently moved back to the cities and was in a more rural setting before and was feeling some anxiety about this change, and she was able to connect with myself, other teens there, and then a therapist that was going to be covering me for me during my family leave. And I think having that time together in a setting that was more casual and fun really helped build their connection as well. We also had a family that was able to get resources, such as the backpacks, and just be together and have fun and play games. And that's really what we need, is that connectedness. And I appreciate that about Family Enhancement Center. We are able to have those opportunities for families. And that's something we really thrive to have as often as possible.
Thank you
for your time. I appreciate it.
And thanks for yours, and thanks for your important work, and to all three of the testifiers for your work. We appreciate it. Any member of the public who wishes to testify on the bill? And not seeing any, and so we're going to move to member questions and discussions. Discussion. Any members have anything that they want to ask or say about the bill? I'm not seeing anything, I guess. And we really appreciate the presentation. Representative Greenman, thoughts? Oh, pardon me. One moment. Oh, I'm so sorry, Lee Daniels. You've been a few meetings. We have this tradition where call Lee Daniels, no matter the bill. So Lee Daniels, please.
Well, I've been gone for 2 weeks, Chair. So maybe,
yeah, yeah, well,
maybe
we're
you
very
just
glad
kinda,
to have you back, sir.
You know, forgot.
Yeah, I sure did. Sorry.
I think it's been going on. I did some Googling on this bill,
okay.
And on the Family Enhancement Center, and what I saw was positive. Reviews were good, and it seems like they're doing a good job. Like the testifier said, 30 years. So that's a good bill, and thank you, Representative Greenman, for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you so much, Lee Daniels. Yes, and I'll notify folks bringing proposals before us. Lee Daniels, we'll Google your we'll check out your reviews on Google,
yes.
No matter who you are. So just be aware of that. So, but in this case, we've got very good reviews, which is excellent. And so, a nice lead-in, Representative Greenman. Final comments from you.
Well, thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Lee Daniels. The last thing I'll say is, you know, what the Family Enhancement Center is doing is working with families. Lots of them are coming out of the Child Protection protection system really vulnerable folks who are dealing with and healing from trauma. And the idea of creating both the therapy work that they do and the mental health work they do, but also doing it in relationship to the mentoring and the community, building community and support, is really a holistic way of looking at what families and kids needs to really to heal and to thrive in our communities. So with that, I'd ask you for your support and lay it over.
Thank you so much, Representative Greenman. And I've had a chance to visit Family Enhancement Center, and it's a wonderful space and a healing space for families and for kids who've experienced trauma. So this is such important work. So thank you for bringing the proposal forward. Thanks to all for your work. And we will, we've got a lot of tough budget decisions to make. We really appreciate you bringing this forward. So with that, the chair lays over House File 2753 for possible inclusion in our committee's budget bill. Thank you again, Representative Greenman, for being here. And Representative Bonner, you are up next if you are here, but you may not be, in which case we may be moving to, we'll get back to that bill. Why don't we do, so we're going to go to Representative Witoon. Would you be up for heading up? Maybe not?
Sure.
Is that okay? Okay.
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll give it to you on your way. We'll keep an eye out.
Yep.
Thank you all again for being with us at Family Hanson Center. Good. So Representative Katiza Witoon, as she is heading up to the front, moves that House File 2864 be brought before the committee. And there is an A2 author's amendment.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
It's mostly a technical amendment based upon some reorganizing some additional language and adding a few cross-references, making the bill a little bit more clear about the deposits beginning at birth instead of at kindergarten entry age.
So I'm thinking, I know there's another amendment as well. I'm just thinking this through. I'm kind of inclined to consider the A2, maybe have a discussion about the bill, and then move to the DE3. I'm not sure who's going to be offering the DE3, but is that acceptable to maybe Lee Daniels or to whoever's going to be offering that, to kind of do that in that order? I feel like it's a help, because that way we can sort of talk about the bill, the proposal, and then assess the DE3. But Representative Hudson, or you?
So I'll defer a bit to our partisan research on this. My understanding was that the A2 was going to amend the DE, not the original bill.
Mr. Chair.
Let's go. So Representative Katiza Witoon.
Thank you. Yeah. So Representative Hudson, the A2 amendment is my amendment to amend the original text of the bill.
And so I think the DE3 is the one that would be offered by Representative Hudson.
Perhaps. Correct.
And so I'm thinking that we'll consider the author's amendment, discuss the bill, and then when we get to discussion, then at that point you can move the DE3 if that's, is that work for you, Representative Hudson?
It does, thank
okay.
you.
Okay, good. Okay, great. So then, Representative Katiza Witoon, I think you described the A2. Any further discussion or questions about the A2? So just to get the bill in the form the author wishes, all in favor of approval of the A2 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, so the bill is amended. So Representative Katiza Witoon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, before us today is House File 2864, as amended, the Mini Kids Act, KIDS, as in Kids Investment and Development Savings Act. The purpose of this bill is to assist every single child in Minnesota in opening a savings account, financial education, and later upon graduation from high school, utilizing those funds that have matured for college or career training. This proposal is based on a successful pilot program led by the City of St. Paul that the state partnered with the City of St. Paul back in 2019. And you have a handout in your packets from the Mini Kids Coalition. You'll see very positive results within the local community and just a little bit of financial support. So the data is really tremendous in that if somebody has just $500 in a savings account at graduation, they are three times more likely to attend college or other secondary education, and four times more likely to graduate. So it's really, it can really make a big difference. And you know we've had, I think, a really positive conversation in this committee earlier in the session just about how important financial education is and in helping folks move in that direction. But I'm happy to continue that on later on, but I just wanted to point out that data really quickly. And since we are short on time today, I would be happy now to introduce my testifiers to provide a little bit more detail on the both the pilot program and then this proposal going forward.
That would be great. Yeah, so Christy Snyder, I think, is the first one. Yeah, come on up. Once you get settled in, please identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Christy Snyder, and I'm the director of the Twin Cities Opportunity Youth Network at Youth Prize. I'm grateful to be here today as part of a wide and committed team trying to bring many kids' child savings accounts to open up to a wide variety of post-secondary options to all children in Minnesota. And I'm so grateful to you for championing this bill. Many kids would collaborate with families to open up custodial accounts with a $50 seed deposit for every baby born in Minnesota and a $100 seed deposit for every baby born to a low-income family in the state, starting July 1st, 2024. This would jumpstart savings for 70,000 Minnesota babies born each year. In designing with families, we've been thoughtful of our state's goal of ensuring 70% of all Minnesotans have attained a post-secondary certificate or degree. And while with these babies, we'll have a long way to go. It's an innovative program such as these that change the trajectory of what can be achieved, both for the babies and their families. So these funds can be used for technical and vocational schools, four-year colleges and universities, higher ed and nonprofit certificate programs, all approved by the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act by DEED. It's important that we also include the partnership grants. This is a critical component of the element of the Mini Kids, so that local communities can apply for grants to really shift the narrative so they can use marketing, community engagement, programming, wraparound support, staffing for local coordination, and build up the Mini Kids accounts with additional deposits. This is a new narrative for Minnesotans. The startup grants are for new communities, so that 50% go to the metro area, 50% to greater Minnesota, and then also for existing child savings accounts. And where Youth Prize is named as the intermediary, I know that there's been some controversy about having named intermediaries. Whether it's us or whether it's somebody else, Youth Prize manages and re-grants public and private funds, which means we shoulder a significant compliance burden and work to build the capacity and ensure the compliance of our subgrantees. We've learned a lot. We have appropriate resources currently at our organization. In fact, Youth Prize has distributed over $50 million in our tenure. We have a large compliance officers, and we currently do distribute state funds successfully. I'm so excited about Mini Kids. I'm so excited about what it means for our state and what that means for the possibilities of our economic vitality moving forward. So thank you so much, Representative, for authoring this.
And thanks, Ms. Snyder. Thanks for your testimony. Thanks for your work. Mayor Carter-Ramos is next. Please, once you sit down, identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Munir Karcher-Ramos, and I'm the director of the Office of Financial Empowerment with the City of St. Paul. In 2019, as our chief author mentioned, the state legislature appropriated $500,000 to the City of St. Paul to launch a pilot children's savings account program, which we call College Bound St. Paul. And for us, we're really interested in the City of St. Paul for launching a CSA because of the broad research evidence. As our chief author mentioned, again, I just want to repeat it, is that children who have anywhere between $1 and $500 in a savings account are three times more likely to go to college and four times more likely to graduate. It's less about the amount of money in the account, but that there's an account there at all. The account provides a tangible conversation between a parent and a child, a tangible account for the community to invest in, and tangible hope for the possibilities of what the future may hold, you know, for the child. With that said, the city used the pilot funds to launch College Bound St. Paul, a CSA program starting at birth for every newborn born in the City of St. Paul. $50 is placed in the child's account, and they're able to earn bonus deposits. Families are able to deposit funds into their accounts as well. Again, that launched January 1st of 2020. We have now over 9,500 children enrolled in the program with over $1.1 million in savings. The average account size is $129, and the largest account now is over $6,500. And each of these children are just turning 3 years old. Families are so excited. We get calls and emails from mothers and fathers all across the city every week who can't wait for their child's account to be opened and for them to receive a welcome kit, and includes one of these. I'm a college-bound St. Paul. I'm a college-bound baby. Also in our work, you know, we're really thinking about, there's a letter here from Craig Leopold, the owner of the Minnesota Wild, who's the co-chair of College Bound, who really states, you know, how well this bill is moving from a citywide pilot to a statewide policy, that there's several learnings we believe should be held in a statewide program, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but some of them is that it should be universal eligibility, automatic enrollment with opt-out options, automatic initial deposit, ongoing investment over time, and that the accounts are safeguarded, meaning they're custodial accounts, that way it doesn't impact, individuals' benefits and that sort of thing. And then the last part, are those local coordination grants, both the expansion and startup grants. So in closing, Mr. Chair and members, this piece of legislation would move the state of Minnesota from pilot to policy, making Minnesota the 18th state with a statewide CSA program. Let's jumpstart savings for 70,000 Minnesota babies each year. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your hard work both in St. Paul. Thank you on behalf of, as a St. Paul representative, and then for your testimony and work on this too. Thank you. Is there any member of the public who wishes to testify on the bill? That's a question. Not seeing anybody, so we'll move to member discussion. I know Vice Chair Keeler had raised a question. If you're,
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I have a question about the interest that's gained on savings. Who benefits from that? Does the interest go directly into the child savings account, or is there some sort of administrative cost that covers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Keeler. I actually had the same question. So the family or the child gets to keep that interest. These are, though, halal-friendly accounts, so if a family is not able to utilize a savings account that garners interest, then that interest money would go back to the program and kind of continue funding other accounts.
Mr. Keeler.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. My next question is, it sounds like this is designed for children who stay with their same family or adults in their life. We know that we have, from my communities alone, a lot of our babies are placed in out-of-home placement. So walk me through how those transactions work. So from when a baby is born to when they go to college, if there's been, many maneuvers in their life, how do we make sure that money would stay with that child?
Representative Katiza Witun, or your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll start, but then I'll allow Munir to explain a little bit more how it works in practice. But this was one of the concerns that I actually brought to Mayor Carter and the City of St. Paul when we were initially considering this pilot program. As you know, I'm a former foster parent, and so that was one of my main concerns, particularly that the money, that it be a custodial account such that the money that's there remains for the child. It can travel with the child, so it's kind of a portable benefit, if you will, and that the money can't be withdrawn for should a parent or foster parent or whomever is being able to contribute to the account, that they not have access to take that money out of the account. And I think I'll let.
Your testifier, Mr. Christian Ramos, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so their custodial account, so the custodian would be the program administrator in the bill. And when we say they're safeguarded, it means that the child is a named beneficiary, so it follows the child, and no one else can access those funds all the way up until what we call the asset purchase, which would be the education business program, whatever it may be. So it would be under the kid's name as a beneficiary. They're the only ones who would be able to have any access to it.
Mr. Killing. Good. Yeah, thank you. I know a lot of thought went into the design of the St. Paul program, and it's working well. I was there on that first day, actually, January 1, 2020, and it was really, really exciting. Other questions, discussion, members? Obviously, we're going to get to, maybe at this point, it does make sense to get to the amendment, Representative Hudson, if you're ready for that, if you want to do that. Yeah, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the DE amendment, DE3, obviously by virtue of being a DE, makes a radical change to the structure of the proposal. And so I want to take some time to explain the thought process behind that. So as I go through the written testimony and the materials and the bill itself, it seems as though the underlying premise of this is summarized, because it's repeated time and time again throughout the letters of testimony. It's summarized in this sentence here in the letter from the St. Paul Children's Collaborative. Research indicates that children from low-income households with savings for college of just $1 to $499 are three times more likely to attend college and four times more likely to graduate than low-income children who do not have savings accounts for higher education. Taking that correlation for granted, the premise seems to be that it is the having of the money in an account and the having of the account that has some sort of causal relationship to the kids being more likely to go to college and more likely to graduate. And what I would submit is that what we're actually seeing here is that the values, priorities, habits, and practices that exhibit themselves in seeking a savings account and making deposits into it, that those values, habits, and practices are what translate and exhibit themselves in kids being more likely to attend college and more likely to graduate. And so the idea that by just handing people an account and handing them money to put into it, that that's going to translate into the same correlation and outcomes, I think, especially when you're looking at a pilot program that started in 2019, and you know, here we are less than 5 years later, it's a fairly dubious notion. And I think we can do this a lot simpler than it's currently being proposed. I mean, under this proposal, not only do we have the named intermediary youth prize that, according to one of the one sheets here, is going to be getting $570,000, over $500,000 to administer this thing. But they act as the program administrator, as opposed to the Department of Education under the original bill before the author's amendment. And they get to select a financial institution, one, that's going to hold this money. And I appreciate Vice Chair Keeler raising the issue of interest, because the interest that you earn on your account is only part of the interest that is earned on the money that is held in that account. That's how the bank makes its money. And so what this does is this ensures that on an ongoing basis, some financial institution chosen by Youth Prize is going to be making guaranteed amounts of money based on guaranteed deposits from public funds. I think we can avoid all of that. I think we can save everyone a whole lot of money, especially the state and the taxpayer, by utilizing and leveraging the existing 529 accounts, college savings accounts that already exist. And so what this amendment does, what the DE3 does, is it instructs the commissioner to make seed deposits in the same amount as this bill, $100 for a child who's eligible to participate in free and reduced lunch, $50 for other eligible children, and the eligibility requirements are similar, if not identical, to the ones that are in your bill, Representative Katizawatun. Really, it just simplifies the whole process, but then it goes back to that desire of seeking the account, seeking the deposit, opting in. Opt in is buy in, and buy in is what I believe translates to a pattern of behavior and values that's going to improve the odds of these kids someday improving their lives by attending college and graduating. So I would hope that you would consider accepting the DE3. Thank you.
Okay, and Representative, consider that a motion to adopt the DE3 amendment to the bill. Okay. And Representative Katizawatun.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for obviously a lot of thought that you put into this amendment. I like the potential of a 529 connection there. I mean, gaining a little bit more interest and making sure that folks are on the right track. One of my concerns, though, is that part of the problem, is that we know how many Minnesotans are unbanked or underbanked. And I think that, you know, due to a variety of issues, whether they be cultural, whether they be language-based, people in Minnesota, many people in Minnesota just, they have a little bit of a fear going into a bank, setting up an account. I think putting, utilizing a 529 is kind of another step up for people who even know what a 529 is. So I think that there's a lot of financial education that needs to go into a program like this. And I think that that's one of the essential parts of the partnership with community organizations that we've included in the bill, the local partnership grants. And so I think, I mean, that's one part that's not included in your bill. But I would be happy to explore how we may alter between a savings account and an investment account. I think that is really a point well taken, that could kind of, you know, potentially expand the money that the state is providing, but also that the family can provide. So I just think it's really important that we help people enter the world of banking and savings in order to really encourage them to begin. Because, you know, even folks who are making middle income, upper middle income, they, life happens, right? And so you don't necessarily always take the step to open up a savings account or a 529 before it's too late. And we don't know what we don't know. And I think that it's really important that we set this kind of expectation. I think it has to do with the expectation that every child has the ability, has the potential to attend college, to attend some sort of career or technical training. And I think that really is kind of how to see your point, like the values and the consistency and the behavior. I think that I really appreciate that. But I think that we can kickstart that by allowing everyone to participate in a program like this. So I would ask members to vote no.
Okay, thank you. And of course, we're going to give the bill, the author of the motion, the last word. Representative Zeleznikar is next on the list. Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. I appreciate this amendment by Representative Hudson, and the reason is I think it's important that we teach people how to take the step. I mean, banking is a part of life for all of us, regardless where our birth starts. I mean, it is really a critical piece. When I went to the Savage, I went to look at Shakopee High School on a Friday field trip and saw, you know, they have a bank right in the high school to teach the kids. This is something we spend in this committee hours talking about early childhood, community education. We have pathways within all of our districts to teach families and kids about a 529. And whether they're low income or lower middle class or middle class, or they need to all learn this. This is stuff that would be valuable at any bracket, because that interest and the points on the interest being made are very valuable and very valid. And I think that it gives families the flexibility that they need. It teaches children. And if you don't teach the child how to fish and the family how to fish, there is never going to be an amount of programs that we could ever ramp up to be that safety net. We want to have that, and this is a great program for Minnesota, but the federal F-29 that's been established gives us a framework for an opportunity to establish something in Minnesota that just simplifies this and has it being applied in a reasonable way. And I think having, you know, people know ATMs. People know a lot of things about banking today. So I would not underestimate the ability of all people, and through our systems, through public education and community education and all those initiatives we do to teach a 529. If we want to do it, that's definitely going to happen, because we have the wherewithal to do it. And I think that this is a reasonable amendment that gives a pathway that it's cleaner and is going to give the outcome that representative that brought the bill, and I thank you for bringing it. I think it has a lot of merit. I think really listening to this 529 is something that is going to give parents the flexibility they want and give the child the opportunities they need in a teaching way. So thank you. I hope you consider this. I think it's a great amendment.
Thank you, Representative Zeleznikar. It looks like the bill's author wants to respond. Just some comments made.
Thank you, Representative Chair. Representative Pinto and Chair Pinto. It's very early, guys. I haven't had any coffee yet. Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar, for your comments. I think, one thing to consider is that for people who have never even set foot in a bank, I mean, I want to be clear, I'm not underestimating Minnesotans by any stretch of the imagination. I think that it's our job as a state to provide education, to help lift people up. But if somebody, for whatever reason, may it be cultural, maybe it be language, if they've never even set foot into a bank and we say, hey, you can set up this investment account when they don't even know what a 401k is. I mean, I can't say the data right now off the top of my head, but even the people who have access, who have a full-time job, who have an employer that's contributing to a 401k, they don't sign up for it because they don't know what it is and they just don't take that step. So I think that an opt-in program is the wrong way to go. But I think that the flexibility in considering how we could potentially explore the difference between a savings account and an investment account is worth considering. And so, you know, like I said, I appreciate Representative Hudson bringing this amendment. I just don't think that it's the right step at this point in time.
Okay. And back, I guess before we go to the bill's author, I'll just remind folks the bill itself is to the motion's author, I should say. The bill's being laid over today, and I think regardless of what happens with the amendment, it seems like there's, you know, continuing conversations to be had. But Representative Hudson, you get the last word on your own motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Katizawatoon, for the forthright and robust discussion. I think you made my point. If folks lack their knowledge, the wherewithal, the cultural equipment, whatever we're saying the deficit is, that keeps them from being able to access the banking system, then merely handing them a bank account and a deposit isn't going to solve that problem. They're not going to know what to do with it after the fact. There's a big difference between handing somebody something and providing them with the motivation and the wherewithal and the discipline and commitment to see a process through. And I think the danger with the approach that your bill in its current form takes is that when parents get that sticker that says my baby is college bound, they're going to believe it. They're going to believe that having that account and having government money put in it means, translates to their kid going to college. And that's not true. There's a lot of things that need to be done from that point, from birth until their college age, to put them in a position to be able to succeed, to be able to be admitted, to be able to graduate. And so validating this premise that having the account and having the deposit is the reason why you're going to attend college and graduate, It's a false premise that might actually deter people from developing the values, practices, and habits necessary to set their children up for success in the future. So I would encourage members to vote for this, and I would ask for a roll call vote. Thank you.
Okay, a roll call requested. There will be one. And so with that, we've got the D3 amendment in front of us. The clerk will take the roll on the motion.
Chair Pinto?
No.
Chair Pinto votes no. Vice Chair Keeler?
No.
Vice Chair Keeler votes no. Lee Daniels?
Aye.
Lee Daniels votes yes. Representative Bliss?
Aye.
Representative Bliss votes yes. Representative Coulter?
No.
Representative Coulter votes no. Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Davis votes yes. Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Hansen votes no. Representative Hemmingson Yeager?
No.
Representative Hemmingson Yeager votes no. Representative Hicks?
No.
Representative Hicks votes no. Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Representative Hudson votes yes. Representative Katizawatoon?
No.
Representative Katizawatoon votes no. Representative Lee? Representative Lee is excused. Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Nelson votes yes. Representative Pérez Vega is excused. Representative Zalesnikar?
Aye.
Representative Zalesnikar votes yes.
Vote is eight ayes and six. Hold on one moment. Six ayes and seven nays, and so the motion does not prevail. The bill is not amended, and so we do need to keep moving. So Lee Daniels, do you get the last word before the bill's author? Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I have a lot of questions on this, but I'll try to keep it brief because I know we have two more bills coming.
Actually, three.
Three?
That's even worse.
Oh, sorry.
Or even better.
Or even better, that's true.
Yeah.
Got to keep moving.
So anyway, the first point I was, maybe the author could answer, or my question, I guess, are we assuming this, I guess, what are the safeguards to protect against multiple accounts being open to a single child's identity? That was never, I don't think, in any part of the bill. Is there anything built in so they can't do a duplicate?
Let's just get maybe Mr. Carter Ramos. Yeah, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so how we do it in St. Paul is there's a deduplication process that happens, you know, every month, you know, and the legislation, you know, says that a account will be open for a child. So the deduplication process is looking at particularly name and birthday. Is sort of the first vetting, you know, mechanism, and usually, you know, probably accounts for 99%, you know, as we're able to get through name and birthday, and then the other 1% would be crosswalking it with like location, you know, that and the information that we receive to ensure that there aren't duplications.
Thank you, Lee Daniels.
Yeah, thank you for that. In the St. Paul thing that's been going on since 2020, I believe.
January.
Has there been any problems with that in the 3 years that's been going on,
Mr. Cartramos?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there hasn't been any issues with the deduplication or, you know, duplication. No.
Lee Daniels.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for that. Well, I don't have much to say on the program. To be honest, I'm just kind of a personal opinion is I'm against the premise of just handing out money to see if it works or not. And $50, in my personal opinion, is not going to make a difference in a child's life. That's why I was glad with the D3 amendment that it bumped it up to $100. But I'm just against the premise, I guess, and I hate to be a downer, but I don't think this will make a difference between people actually going to college or not. I'll be voting no on the bill if it comes to the floor, and that's my reason for doing that.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. Yeah, and I think Representative Cortez Batum will give you the last word, and yeah, Representative Cortez Batum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, there's so much more that I would like to say today, but I'm going to respect the committee's time, and I know we have a lot of work ahead of us. I will just say that the DE doesn't change the amount of money that that children are getting. It's $50 for eligible children and $100 for lower income children. That's the same as my proposal. And I look very forward to proving Representative Daniels' assumption wrong.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and I think the research that backs up the St. Paul program, this as well, would say that there is good research to back up this proposal. So thank you so much for the bill, Representative Batum. Thank you, Mr. Carter Ramos, Ms. Snyder, for your work. And with that, the chair lays over House File 2864 as amended for possible inclusion in our committee's budget bill. And Representative Bonner, if you can make your way up, wherever you are. And I'm going to ask Vice Chair Keeler, if I can, if you can move House File 2451 to bring that before us.
I move House File 2451 in front of us.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. And then, Representative Bonner, as you settle in, you've got a, looks like a DE amendment. You want to have that moved, Representative Bonner?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have a DE1.
Okay, and Vice Chair Keeler, will you move the DE1 amendment?
So moved.
Okay, and Representative Bonner, the DE1, just quickly give us a sense as to what that's about.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically, the DE1 changes the language to reflect the broader communities supported by the 80 by 3 programs. The amendment also reflects feedback from communities where there's a great need in the child care center space As many of you know, I'm an Agile practitioner, and a big part of that is feedback. This is a five-year program, and the feedback they have received has said that the best and most targeted use of their efforts is in the child care center space. And with less immediate need in terms of preschools. Due to this change, the focus of the amendment also realigns the funding to DHS rather than MDE.
Okay. Any discussion of the DE1 amendment, members? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the amendment's adopted, and so we have in front of us House File 24451 is amended. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2451 appropriates one-time funding to the Greater Twin Cities United Way to support eligible programs that train teachers and caregivers in child care centers on providing trauma-sensitive care to bolster childhood development and lifelong learning in communities facing trauma, often due to poverty, lack of resources, or challenges with housing or food insecurity. And greater levels of trauma, often known as ACEs, which I think you're familiar with. What we know is that nearly 12,000 three-year-olds in the Greater Twin Cities area have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience, such as community violence, abuse, or unrelated mental health disorders in the home. Without intervention, it is estimated that today's three-year-old will incur over $210 million per year in trauma-related medical costs when they reach adulthood, totaling about $3.3 billion over their lifetimes. The stakes are high for our littlest Minnesotans. The program before you was forged on the knowledge that 80% of the knowledge of the brain development and early learning is formed in the first 3 years of a child's life. A time when formative experiences are formed and lifelong success can begin. Knowing this, the United Way has formed the Resilient from the Start initiative in partnership with communities deeply invested in changing the path for our earliest learners to an experience filled with love, learning, and the foundations to thrive. This five-year journey was designed to work hand-in-hand with community child care centers on the ground doing this important work to find pathways to well-trained and healthy staff, healthy children, and ultimately healthy communities. It does this by training early childhood centers who are uniquely poised to mitigate the negative effects of childhood trauma in our kids through trauma-sensitive care in the position to affect long-term care. In short, In this process, they create trauma-sensitive professional development curriculum and training into classroom practice that is essential for quality care that buffers the effects of childhood trauma in our kids. Members, please join me in supporting House File 2451.
Thank you so much, and you've got a testifier here. Please identify yourself. I'll say we're pretty tight on time, but so glad to have you. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, all members of the community. My name is Diana Alvarez. I'm the Early Childhood Programs Director at Centro Tayron Guzman, the oldest and largest Latinx organization in Minneapolis. For more than 45 years, Centro Tayron Guzman has been a space of transformational experience through the holistic approach to education, health, and wellness for the entire age span of Latinx families in Minnesota. One of our programs is Siembra Montessori, a four-star parent accelerator program that has provided early childhood education to Latinx children aged 3 to 6 years from low-income families for more than 20 years. As a culturally specific organization, we have responded to our community's needs while helping community members develop and share their assets. An estimated 95% of our participants have been impacted by trauma in their lives, from the trauma that led them to migrate to the United States to the racism and poverty they have experienced as immigrants in Minnesota. 2 years ago, in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, our Siembra staff started noticing an increase of anxiety, stress, and trauma in our children that prevented them from learning and engaging in a day-to-day activities. Our staff delivered what we call psychological first aid to children and their families, but they knew that they needed more training and resources to better support our families. Many of our children and families were referred to mental health professionals, but the limited number of Spanish-speaking culturally appropriate providers led to long wait times to much-needed mental health services. The 80 by 3 United Way initiative has provided us with valuable trainings on how to deliver trauma-sensitive care, giving us tools to open up conversations about events and experiences in the life of children and families, and helping our staff understand behaviors through the new lens. Also, it has provided us with a common language that helps our multi-generational workforce to talk about mental health topics. Historically, trauma is not well understood in the oldest generation of Latino community, and the warning signs of psychological distress often go unnoticed or disregarded as normal reactions. The 80 by 3 initiative has given our staff the space to reflect. We help us to feel less isolated and part of a larger community that are facing similar challenges. As a leader, I have had the opportunity to connect with peers from other organizations to share challenges and exchange best practices. I feel supported by the larger community of organizations that 80 by 3 initiative has connected me with, and the tools they have provided to support my team and the families we serve. Healthy brain development is proven to provide the foundation for better outcomes through the whole course of life. A person's life, including health, educational success, and economic security. We ask the committee members to support the HF 2451 bill that will empower early childhood caregivers with the skills to better understand the effects of traumatic events so they can be more fully equipped to support children experiencing stress. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your testimony. Thanks for your important work. Are there the public who wish to testify on the bill? Not seeing any. Moving to member discussion or questions. And maybe I will ask one. This is asking for $6 million, proposing that. Is there a breakdown? Like how does that money, what does that go to?
Mr. Chair, I do have someone here from the Greater Twin Cities United Way that may be able to answer that question.
Okay. Yeah, please. Yeah, once you get settled in, please identify yourself and if you can answer the question.
Thank you very much, Chair Pinto and committee members. My name is Jamie Bonzik. I'm the program officer for Greater Twin Cities United Way. When we talk about the budget, and we said 5 years over time, so we secured through philanthropic dollars the funding to do the seed money, to meet with community over time, do focus groups, all of the background. What we have found is that through the work that needs to happen in order to bring all the initiatives together, or all the community members, create the content. So really what we're looking at is over time, it is taking roughly $2 million a year to do the work. So we have over 5 years, we've secured money to do some of the work. We're asking for the state buy-in, but also what this allows for us to do is over time, so that at the end of a grant period, oftentimes what happens in nonprofits is like, that was a really nice thing we did together one time. We want to make this sustainable over time and make sure that the work is embedded in the local nonprofit early childhood landscape so that it continues and that it's not a, although we're asking for a one-time investment, we really want to make sure that we maximize on that investment and that the work is sustainable over time.
I guess I'm asking a more, so thank you. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm asking a more concrete question, like literally where does the $6 million, like what does it go to?
Oh, sure. Thank you. So we've had to do content creation. So we heard from the community that the education that existed in the ecosystem before really worked to support people who were right new into the field, and that content meaning professional development for people who had been in the field longer than 3 years, or for those who are leads in design, so leaders of programs, didn't exist. So we partnered with Center for Inclusive Childcare, Think Small Institute, to make the content. What we will also need to make sure is that we have the funding to allow for that content to be out from behind a paywall, meaning that we would like to make sure that that content is available to providers and leaders at no cost to them, so that we make the healthy choice, the easy choice, so that we make sure that the knowledge is, we're not creating a larger knowledge and implementation gap. So that's part of it. We also do a community of practice, so we fund people to come together. We work with Propel nonprofits. They provide technical assistance to the nonprofits to make sure that the policy procedures happen within the organizations so that the ecosystem, the health is there within the organization. And then the other funding comes from grants to implement and pay for paid time for the professionals to do the training and development.
Okay, so I guess we'll need to move on, but I guess we'll invite you to do, and the folks supporting this would be to provide a breakdown of kind of where the dollars go.
That'd correct.
Be helpful. So good, thank you. If you can send that in. Other member, yeah, Representative Davis. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner. How many, in the past, how many teachers and caregivers have been trained through this United Way program?
Ms. Bontic.
Currently, we have 125 people in the cohort that are receiving the support at this time. We have, we'll be working to open up another cohort of supported individuals later on in this month. But essentially, like the funding will allow us to scale and replicate.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner. How many kids has this helped so far in the past?
In the cohort, we have 450 children and families.
Representative Davis.
Okay, and then, so this is for Greater Twin Cities United Way, and sorry, I missed the beginning.
Oh,
so
yeah, that's all right.
You're looking at me because you know it's coming. So how many kids does this help outside the Greater Twin Cities in Minnesota, and how many teachers and caregivers have been trained in Greater Minnesota outside of the Twin Cities metro suburb area?
I'm going to start sort of asking everybody to have very, and that was a short question, but ask everybody short questions and short answers too if we can, so we can, but I do want to make sure we fit in the other two bills. But
We're currently creating a toolkit and utilizing statewide organizations like Center for Inclusive Childcare and Think Small Institute to make sure that all communities in Minnesota have access. So at this time, we haven't had the opportunity to work with Outstate, but we are working on the toolkit that will allow all communities in Minnesota to have access to the content and the supports.
Final thing, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you. My question is just a follow-up to $6.1 million is a lot of money, and my question is on the financial performance of the United Way, the distribution between Greater Minnesota and the distribution, how that looks, and secondarily, then exactly what the salaries are for top managers within the organization in the salary line.
May not have all that information. Representative Bonner, we'll go to you.
But before we go to my testifier, I do want to just level set in case it got missed during my presentation, and I will apologize for that. This is a part of a five-year program, and they are just in the beginning phases of this piece. The idea was to test the system, to create the curriculum, and essentially be able to train the trainer, if you will, in the childcare space. And from there, the next phase will actually expand the ability to do that across the state, and from not just in the center here, but all the way out to the outer reaches of Greater Minnesota. So I just want to clarify that if it was not clear from my presentation.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll give it to my...
Well, we've got possibly another testifier, Ms.
I don't know that I'm the person
well,
to answer,
got,
so I'm
going
to excuse...
You've got somebody standing by who I think is. So
can I excuse myself?
You certainly can.
Well,
no,
phone
please,
a friend.
No, run. Flee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and representatives. Really appreciate the time. My name is Susan Henches Carter, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and External Engagement at Greater Twin Cities United Way. And I just want to thank you for asking this question, because it's not a question that we are unfamiliar with or haven't been asked before. And so let me just simply say that there are two things that are important here. The first is that we pay with the intention for equity. We pay like any other industry or field, respectfully, and we gather expertise and leaders that are paid fairly for their work. We do benchmarking across the field with all nonprofits and across the state to make sure that we are commensurate with other organizations our size. And I'm looking at Representative Hicks because I know she's been in this field too. As a 20-year practitioner, The other thing I would offer with gratitude and humility is that the United Way and other organizations, I think, are done apologizing for paying for expertise and being as sophisticated as other fields are in making sure we have the best and most qualified staffing. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, we're going to go back to Mrs. Lissaker.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I asked a question, and the question was not answered. So there's no apology needed. I've been a leader, and I believe in equitable pay and believe that there are leaders in every industry that the state of Minnesota funds in nursing homes, assisted living, child care, teachers. We do equity pay. I simply want to know, as a responsible elected official, how much we are paying for leaders in grant-funded programs versus leaders in other state-funded programs that are also equitable. So I need to know the percentage, not questioning the intent, not questioning anything else, but I want to know what that is. Yeah. I can't see it on the financials. I'm a math person, and it's not broken down. So if you could answer that question, that would be helpful.
Well, and
sure.
And it may be that this proposal may or may not be in the budget bill next week, and we can assess at that point. Ms. Hedges Carter,
it's no problem.
No problem. What you're able to provide now, please do, and then the follow-up information you can provide, please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. This is the hearty, good conversation I'm glad you're offering. So in all of our initiative work, we have a calculation of less than 10%. It's about 10% on the entirety of our initiative budget, which we will send to you in detail so you can look at that. So the Charities Review Council would say a standard of practice is 30% on every dollar is usually relayed for administrative costs, and the Greater Twin Cities United Way is really proud of two things: private-public partnerships and a reduced amount of an administrative cost ratio of about 10% on our initiatives.
Here's what I'm thinking is, why don't you provide, I know there is the form that lists being a charity that provides the information. If you could please get that to us to send out. I really do want to keep moving, if I can. Representative Lesnikar, I'll give you the last word if you want them, because I got to go to Daniels and do more bills. So Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you for your response. If you could give a detail to the to the members of this committee, and I also want to know what the organization CEO makes for United Way that oversees all of the United Way. I think it's important that we have complete transparency like we do with all other programs. So thank you.
Absolutely. And we will get that to you, and also we'll look forward to any questions.
Discussion. Yeah, thank you so much. Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you to my team. My head's not here today. You can probably tell that. But good job of trying to get the details, and I'm looking forward to getting more information on the financials as well as Representative Zanzigar. And I'm kind of confused, I guess. One thing I'd make, maybe not a question, but a point, I'm a little confused on Department of Human Services to pay a grant to Greater Minnesota Cities United Way to apparently pay grants to another unnamed nonprofit. So I don't know how much. One thing to add to the financials would be now how much it costs to administer a grant through a grant. I'm not sure how that works.
And I'm not so sure that that's how it's structured and stated, but we'll give the Representative Bonner the last word. Lee Daniels, are you?
I'm done. My
Representative Bonner, last word that you got on your bill.
Certainly, just to clarify, they actually are working in partnership with community organizations, and so I thought that was also clear in my presentation. But that said, I just wanted to say that, you know, realistically, we have seen some great challenges, particularly in the last couple of years. And there has been a great deal more trauma within some of our communities. And I think the idea behind this program is really to build that resiliency into the communities who need it most at a time of great need. And being that this is not something that is normally something that these individual organizations within our communities could necessarily spin up on their own. The United Way saw a need and a gap and said, we would like to build the public-private partnership to make sure that we can train the trainer, that we can help our early childhood educators to be trauma-informed, to make steps to make sure that in those formative years that we get our kiddos off to a good start, that we address these issues from the beginning. And with that, I will ask for your support.
Thank you so much. I'll ask Ms. Hensch-Garter to please send in the information requested. You can get it to Ms. Colburn, the CA, and we'll distribute it.
Will do.
With that, the chair lays over House File 2451 as amended for possible inclusion of the committee's budget bill. Representative Bonner, thank you for your work, and thanks, folks from United Way. And Ms. Bonzig, nice to see you again, and thanks for your work. So, Representative Norris, please make your way to the front. I'm going to ask Vice Chair Keeler to move House File 2141 to bring that before us.
So moved before us.
Thank you. And Representative Norris, I don't see any amendments, and so please dive in. We are very tight on time. I'll just remind you and your testifier, so sorry about that. But please dive in and present your bill.
That's all right. Thank you, Chair Pinto. We'll be quick. This is hopefully an easy bill. It's a bipartisan one. It's about good government and the state allowing our local partners to do their jobs more effectively. New county employees who will be administering programs like SNAP have to go through a training from DHS before they can begin working. However, you know, counties like my county of Anoka are struggling to get their new employees through the required training in a timely and efficient manner. And it's not uncommon for new hires to have to wait 4 to 6 months to start as a result. There's several issues that are causing this. One is that the training typically only takes place once a month, so employees can only start around that once per month training date. Second, the trainings are limited to only 20 seats per class, and that's for all 87 counties plus the tribes. So counties may have to delay hiring or training for new staff if a particular once per month training is full. Third, counties can only reserve 5 of those 20 spots in the training, which limits the number of staff that they can onboard at one time. So this bill would allow counties who have the in-house resources to do so to pilot providing in-house training for certain programs for 1 year. It would give those counties more flexibility in their hiring and their onboarding processes while freeing up the spaces in the state-run training for smaller counties that can't do their own training. And this is not a problem that's unique to Anoka County. We've got letters of support from the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, St. Louis County, Wright County, Dakota County. So this is a problem that we're seeing all across the state. I think this pilot program and this bill is a common sense solution to a serious workforce and workload challenge for our counties.
Thank you, Representative Norris. And Jessica Leth, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Leth, and I'm the Director of Economic Assistance for Anoka County. The hiring and retention of financial workers has been a concern for many years, but this concern has grown with the increase in work counties have experienced during the pandemic. And with the restarting of annual renewals in public health care programs, the needs for counties to be fully staffed is critical. Under the current training structure, when a county hires a new financial worker, they are required to attend training through the Department of Human Services to learn the basics of program policy. The training is offered typically one time per month by a schedule set by DHS and is capped at 20 seats for all 87 counties and tribes. If training is offered only one time per month, the training dates and available slots may not align with the county's hiring needs. This is a challenge when counties are experiencing multiple vacancies coupled with an unprecedented amount of work. There have been numerous times throughout the years when Anoka County has had to pass up qualified applicants because they had a conflict with the timing of the DHS training or there are not enough timing or training slots available. Anoka County is not unique in this experience. Many colleagues in other counties have experienced the same issues when trying to fill vacancies and train employees. Wright County experienced a period where, due to various circumstances, they did not have staff who were trained in family cash or child care assistance programs. When they tried to get staff into training, either training was not offered at DHS or the classes were full. Anoka County currently has multiple financial worker vacancies. If we are limited to set training dates and a cap on training seats through DHS, we will continue to have vacancies for months to come. Many of the counties that do have the resources and interest to do in-house training already have an extensive county training program for new staff that is done in addition to DHS's training. We also recognize that there are many counties that do not have the capacity to provide in-house training and rely on DHS to train new employees. Allowing some counties to train in-house will open up more slots in the DHS's training for those counties unable to train in-house. So I'm here before you today to ask for your support on House File 2141. This is a one-year pilot that would allow some counties with the available resources the flexibility to fill staff vacancies so we can provide essential services to our community members in a timely manner. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public who should testify on the bill? Seeing none, member questions or discussion? Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. Noor, and thank you. I said Chair Noor. Sorry. I heard this in the other one, which is what my brain is saying. Thank you. Representative, I can't see you, but I heard this bill in another committee, and I support this. I think it's indicative, though, to a broken system. And I say that I commend the counties at the local level. I believe in local government having mentorship programs because I worked in St. Louis County, and I have continued to work in Lake County and St. Louis County for the last 30 years. And I've watched what's happened with retirements and passing on knowledge and the difficulties it is to get eligibility and have records and have systems transferred to the next employee. There's a huge learning curve to what these benefits are to actually deliver and to administer for the citizens. So this backlog in this, the timetable of when classes are offered, one would think it would be simple with Zoom after doing it for 2.5 years, that you could have a large classroom with DHS and everybody would get trained on multiple times, and it doesn't work that way. And so the system is broke. I commend Anoka County for taking a lead. I hope other counties will do the same thing. And if they have the knowledge within their county to train their people so that we can end this delay that's delaying services in a seamless way to the citizens we serve. And it is clearly, it is broken, and for people to use the system right now, they are waiting on hiring and waiting on applicants to be able to get training. So I support this bill 100%. Like I said in the other committee, I hope we're able to do peer mentoring county to county to share knowledge on baseline knowledge that one county might have with a 20-year employee.
We've got three more people to go, and we're almost out of time.
It's a great bill.
Thank you so much. We picked that up. Excellent. So Representative Nelson, to you, and then we're going to go to Lee Daniels and Representative Norris.
All right.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you for this bill, Representative Norris. I think I would echo much of what Representative Selesnikar said on this. I think it's many ways the system is broken. One of my questions I have is, do you see is there going to be a savings or a cost on the counties? I could see a potential savings because I'm assuming if they have an employee going to a training, they're covering probably some travel costs, especially you get into St. Louis or Roseau counties. There's probably a fair amount of travel and things like that involved. But at the same time, if they can train in-house, I think in future there's probably some savings here. And then also just as you're training somebody, you also kind of help build a rapport with them. And I think there's some great possibilities in this, and I'd love to see this going forward.
Thank you. Really quickly, Ms. Leth, we'll go to you. Ms. Leth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. There is no additional cost to the counties that do this. Like I said, they already have training on site and can take this over. Currently, training through DHS is offered by Zoom. So counties aren't also paying for the expense for employees to go to DHS training.
Thank you so much. Lee Daniels.
Just because of the time, I think we've all had a good discussion, and I think everybody's in support of the bill, so that's what I'm saying. Thank you, Representative Norris, for bringing the bill forward. I think it's a good bill.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. Representative Norris, I'm going to work from you, sir.
Thank you, members, for the great support for this bill. I think it is a common sense one. I also want to thank my partners here in Anoka County for bringing the idea to me, and I think this is one way that we can hopefully innovate to make government work better for all citizens across the state of Minnesota.
Thank you with that. Thank you, Representative Norris. Thanks, Ms. Leth, for bringing this proposal forward. It sounds really good. With that, pardon me, the chair lays over House File 2141 for possible inclusion in the committee's budget bill. Thank you so much. And I'm going to head up, and Vice Chair Keeler is going to speak.
Chair Pinto, while you get settled, would you like to move House File 2292 in front of the committee?
Yeah, actually, I think my motion, Madam Chair, is going to be to move House File 2292 to the Committee on Education and Finance, and then I do have a DE1 amendment.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So members, the DE1 is, so the underlying bill is a vehicle bill. The DE1 is, it contains the administration's proposal for mixed delivery preschool, which if it is funded, will be funded through the education, some portion of it funded through the Education Finance Committee. In any case, it's moving out of our committee and to that committee. And let me think, maybe we can talk about the contents of that, but I'd ask our members to support the DE1 amendment, so I'd move adoption of that, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Amendment is good to go. Go ahead. Do you want to tell us about your bill?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And so, members, as I said, so the bill as amended now contains a proposal for mixed delivery pre-K. There's for 25,000 four-year-olds providing access to preschool in a variety of settings. So it's, again, mixed delivery includes school-based settings. I'm thinking one of my kids was in school-based pre-K. Another child was in preschool at a community community provider, a Head Start as well, a number of areas there. I'd ask your members to support this to send it on for consideration in the Education Finance Committee.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Is there anybody from the public wishing to testify on House File 2292? I'm seeing none. Member discussion? None? Oh, Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair Pinto, I my question is just understanding fully how this is going to affect the family child care providers, because in Greater Minnesota, that is, I'm getting bombarded with calls. We had 700 closures this last year. My biggest concern is how this plays out. I support many aspects of this. Obviously, we all want children to be, but I, from what the families are telling me, is that you get the least amount of reimbursement for an infant and a toddler in family child care. You get the most reimbursement as the child gets older, which seems hard for me to comprehend, having been a person that cared for seniors, because the higher care, it was the opposite. So my question is just how this, in my mind, I envision that some family child care providers are going to see children leave and further implode child care for families in Greater Minnesota. So I just want to fully understand this, Chair Pinto, because I want to make sure we have center-based and family-based. It's just that the opportunities are so different across the state. I want to make sure we don't have some gap here that we just don't understand, and that we aren't going to have something else fail significantly at a point when we can't afford to have any more family closures, and we actually need to increase family daycare providers. So if you could help me understand that, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Curler, and thank you, Representative Lesnikar. So first of all, directing your attention to line 2.20 in the bill. So family child care providers are absolutely, they will be preschool providers under this proposal. So right there, boom, we've got that covered. You're right that we need to be doing a lot more, and I think as you see our committee's budget bill next week, you're going to see a lot more going on there. The reason that that there's more, that sort of funding works more at four-year-olds is because the ratios work better, because you can have more four-year-olds per classroom than you can for younger kids. And as you say, the care is so much needed more for the younger kids. Families are in just even that much worse a position. We know that as kids are getting older, it's a little bit easier for families to be able to get income coming in compared to those infants and toddlers. So the economics of the sector are really totally messed up. We've been hearing a lot about that in our committee, more to discuss. But in any case, no, our family child care providers are covered under this bill, and we want to make sure that they continue to stay in operation.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going to jump in just because can I add a clarifying question of what was just said?
You're the chair.
I want to go to research, because you mentioned reimbursement rates are smaller or lower for infants and higher for toddlers.
Yeah,
I just wanted, can we have house research? Annie, go ahead. Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for CCAP reimbursement, right, the reimbursement rates are higher for infants and toddlers than they are for older children.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. I just, that was said, and I just wanted to double check that. Go ahead, Chair Pinto.
No, no, that's good. Great question, Madam Chair. So,
Representative Zalesikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto. My question just is, you know, as we move these bills forward to really have a lot of insight on how this is going to affect greater Minnesota, and I want to have, you know, child care for the entire state, because it is the number one thing I hear, one of them anyway. And so as we look at this, the ratios of children aren't the same in family. There isn't exactly the ratios in centers and the ratios in family child care is different. In the family model, your children count in the count. There's a lot of different things that I think we really have to look at, how these implications are affecting us in 2023, so that if somebody wants to be start a family child care, they're not prohibited by regulations that maybe, while well-intended, are having unintended consequences. And so I want us to look at what these ratios are and then look at that piece of it, of how we move forward so that, you know, families and children are served in the best way statewide. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Pinto?
Just to have very happy to continue working with you on the family child care issue is really important. And I know that the chair, the vice chair, is going to keep an eye on greater Minnesota, too. Thanks.
Yeah. To follow up with that, Representative Zalesikar and I have been really having some in-depth conversation about the importance of family daycares and how that plays a role in greater Minnesota. So I appreciate you bringing that up. With nobody else on the list, we'll go to Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Keeler. I have the same concerns as Representative Zalesikar. My wife and I, when she was working at the kindergarten center in Bemidji, she was a para there, and we had three young children at the time, and we did a quick arithmetic check, and we're actually losing money sending her to work every day. So she quit her job, stayed home for about 3-4 years, and everything worked out, you know, fine. But if we take four-year-olds out of the equation, and I remember when my boys were four, they were actually helping take care of other kids in our household at that time. And that seems like what the bill is going to be intending to do, is to take four-year-olds away from the family daycare and put them into the school functioned role. And I just, I'm same sentiment, is that I think we're going to be losing a lot of family daycare centers because of that. So that's my comment. I'm a little leery of how this is going to pan out in the future. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you, members of the discussion. I'll maybe just note that it is just so frustrating, isn't it, that the economics of this sector is so messed up that you've got the overworked, underpaid parents of four-year-olds subsidizing the even more overworked, even more underpaid parents of infants and toddlers, and that that we would have that be sort of be the factor. We want to make sure that every child gets off to a great start, every child gets the high-quality early learning that they need. And this proposal will do that, and I'd ask members to support it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Chair Pinto renews his motion to refer House File 2292 as amended to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. The bill passes as amended. It's heading to Education Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I might just briefly, members, just to confirm for next week. So so you can expect to have, let me see if I can move here, be able to see people better. You should expect to have our committee's budget bill out early next week, and the plan, again, is a walkthrough on Tuesday. We'll be taking testimony on Wednesday and then doing a markup, including amendments being offered on Thursday. I don't know if members have questions about that, but I want to make, we're sort of at a key pivot point in the schedule, and I know we have a lot of first-term members, especially on the committee, and so folks have questions about that. Be happy to do that. Otherwise, I know that we're over time, too, but... so I'm very happy to talk with folks. Please connect with me. There'll be a lot going on in the next week and a half. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep, I would just add a reminder, too, that our Wednesday committee is over in CAP 120.
Oh.
So we will have options for virtual testifying, and give yourself a little bit extra time for the extra stuff. So with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, members.